this session is called Everybody is a Theologian. And it is an introduction to work that I'm going to be doing this week, in the sense that we want to talk a little bit tonight about how theology is not some kind of specialty, but is in fact something that everybody does, whether they're Christian or not, and no matter how thoughtful they are in terms of working out complicated concepts of the world or the universe or anything like that. So tonight, the plan is, at least, to have you help me pick up some echoes from the theologians that live all around us, that is, your parents, you, your friends, people you work with, and talk a little bit about what their comments say about their theology. And then later this week, in other sessions, I will be dealing with some more specific areas like creation, and like the doctrine of humanity, and on Saturday, I think, something on the cults. But we just threw that one in because I figured everybody would be doing something else on Saturday, and we're going to have a little fun session on Saturday. Now, I have on the board three questions, and I hope you can see the board pretty well, because they're the kinds of questions that people are asked by their children, usually, and since you're people, very often you have had to give answers to these sorts of questions, or they are asked by adults. I have heard some of them even lately. So what I'd like to do first is to have us look at one of these questions and talk a little bit about the kinds of responses, the kinds of instant answers that people usually give to those questions. And I'm going to ask you to give me those answers because you're the people who hear them. And I'm going to write them down, and then we're going to see how those answers begin to say something about people's theologies. Okay, now first we have to vote. That's always part of the democratic process. There are three questions, and any one of them can lead us pretty far. So I'd like to have you, I'll read them off the board. I'd like to have you pick one that you'd like to respond to in terms of answers you've heard or given. And we'll work on that for a while, and then if we get tired of that, we'll go to something else. But it's not necessary that we cover all three of them. I would like to say a little bit about most of them, or three of them if we can, but I'd like to concentrate on the ones that you're most interested in. So the questions are, what happens when I pray? That's a religious question. Why do some people have all the luck? That is sometimes not asked by religious people. And why are there mosquitoes? Which are sometimes asked by people before they say religious things in a non-religious way. Okay, let's start with, you got one vote now, that's another thing about the democratic process, right? Okay. Now, which one of these would you like to start with? How many would like to start with number one? Okay, how many would like to start with number two? How many would like to start with number three? Okay, looks like between two and three. So let's start with two, and we can go from there. The second question is, why do some people have all the luck? And I am now going to try to write down some of the answers that you hear. And they don't have to be long, please, but you know, when somebody says to somebody else in your hearing, why do some people have all the luck? What kind of answers do normally we hear?
Born lucky.
They must have done something good. Sung to Rodney Hammerstein.
Or right. That's something
good. Is that it?
That's been Sound of Music.
Hey, that's...
Must have done something good.
Okay, must have done something good, and that's a direct quote from Hammerstein.
Theologian.
Okay, what else?
Barton with the red star.
Silver spoon in her mouth.
Okay, boy, we got two. Silver spoon upstairs, or where was that? Silver spoon was one. Born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and there was another one about a star.
Born under the right star.
Born under the right star, okay?
In the right place at the right time.
Okay, that's a usually heard one. Right place at the right time. What else?
Always gets out of the right side of the bed.
Okay, keep them coming.
The guardian angel is watching out for us.
Okay, got a guardian angel watching, or somebody up there likes them. Okay, guardian angel. What? Not what you know, but who you know.
He made his own luck.
In the right place at the right time.
Okay, I got that one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now that shows that it's very popular.
Two votes.
There was a good one after not what you know, but who you know. And I was over here. Make your own luck?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, any others? Let me read you the ones I've got and see if you can think of any others. Well, some people are born lucky. Must have done something good. Born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Born under a lucky star. Right, being in the right place at the right time. Getting on the right side of bed. Guardian angel watches over them. Not what you know, but who you know. Make your own luck. Any others?
I don't know how different it is. They must live right.
They must live right. Yeah, that's often heard too. They must live right. Any others?
Filled with the Holy Spirit.
Filled with the Holy Spirit. Why do some people have all the luck? Okay. Others?
Cream rises to the top.
Cream rises to the top. Okay, others? That's a good bunch to start with. I mean, probably work with. Okay. What we're dealing with on this question of why do some people have all the luck is what one thoughtful person has called the riddle of human inequality. The riddle of human inequality. It's a very puzzling, real question for people. And it can be expressed in many other ways than this. But this is one of the ways that it's often phrased. Now, the answers that we have given can be divided into two general kinds of attitudes. One of them is, as I look down the list, that somehow the stars were right. You know, you're lucky because you were born lucky. You were lucky because you were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. See, all of these are, it's not up to this person. They've got some kind of, they are fated. They are somehow determined. Born under a lucky star. You can't put it better than that. That's the astrology bit. I've often said I'm a great believer in astrology. Horoscopes. I really, really go for that. I'm a Pisces. Got any other Pisces here? One. Two. Okay. How about Leos? Got any Leos? Well, I see a few of the rest of you look at your horoscope occasionally, too. I'm very serious about this. Every morning I get the paper and I look up Pisces and see what it says for the day. And if I don't like what I find under Pisces, I read on down and it's appropriate for the day. Well, the whole astrology business, of course, is simply that same kind of idea that because of a certain relationship of the planets when people were born, their lives are determined. They are shaped. Their personalities are somehow fixed. Okay, they're at the right place at the right time. That's sort of the same way, I think. We're listening now for those that were sort of determined. Okay, let's see. Cream rises to the top. That could be either way. Which way did you mean that?
Which way did I mean it?
Yeah. No,
I'm
when
just
people
giving
say
what I hear.
Okay, when people say cream rises to the top, do they mean that generally people are born lucky, or
you
make it on your own?
Make
it on your own.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that's the other alternative. The other alternative is to say there's no such thing as luck. Right? You make it on your own. That's that. Now listen to how many of those we've got. You live right. One somebody said, you make it on your own. Not what you know, but who you know. I don't know what to do about guardian angels. Now that might be a something, you know, that is sort of predetermined, or it may be that you got to keep on the right side of the guardian angel too. Must have done something good. There's a very, Mr. Hammerstein was one of those who believed that you make your own luck. Okay, now, what we've done, if I can stop for a minute and embrace the Lord, as I think you can remember the questions, what we've done is say that there are, in general, two ways of looking at human inequality. Two ways, one of which is to say that people are in some way determined. Sometimes fatalism is used, but the idea is that there's some power, something happens in life that pretty well sets up the options, and in fact may limit the options to the point where if you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth, your whole life's going to be just great. But if you're born to lose, that's the other option. Okay, but the other side then is to say there's no such thing as luck. This is the freedom people, and they say that you make your own luck. Now, who's right? Well, if you've ever been in a discussion, you probably discovered that one of the peculiar things about theologians and theology is that it's awfully hard to prove who's right and who's wrong. And in fact, I'm going to draw a line right down the middle of this board for a moment and say that there is in our thought a kind of horizon. The funny thing about the horizon is that it's always there. The higher you go, the more you see, but there's still a horizon, there's still a limit. Even if you now go on, get on a spaceship and look back at planet Earth, you can only see half of it at once. You're still limited. And there's something about human efforts to try to fathom these riddles that always ends up at what we can call a horizon of, and I'm going to use the word rationality, big word, but what I'm talking about is human reason, the horizon of human reason. We can go so far, and that's why dormitory bull sessions last all night. Because you end up, are we free or are we determined? And everybody's got an argument, and there's a little bit of truth in both, it seems, and so one can battle it back and forth. But most people are theologians in the sense that they have made some kind of decision on this. We're, most of us, on one side or the other. We either think you make your own luck, or we think that some people just are born lucky. So see, we start with a simple question. We then discover that it's really dealing with a very profound human problem. And then we discover that the mind can take it so far and tends to end up then in a kind of dilemma, which way to move. Now let's take another one and see if the same pattern holds. Let's take our third one, because there were a lot of mosquito specialists.
Because cutters prayed for it.
Who prays for them?
Cutters. I didn't say it was the people that sell mosquitoes.
Oh, cutters, right. Okay, they make good business. Okay, if I may, for the moment, erase our pet. No, I'll do this again. I can write it down faster than I can write it on the board. Okay, Carol's already got the spirit. What kind of answers do we get when we say, or what kind of answers can be given for the very difficult question, why are there mosquitoes?
You have
other animals need to eat them.
Okay, the food for other animals.
The devil put them here to test us.
Somebody Are you serious? I've never heard that one. Yeah, but does anyone ever really say something's got to spread malaria? I mean, I'm trying to get answers that people normally give. That's what I'm betting on. God put them there. Okay, that's another one. See, the one before that was the devil put them there, somebody said. Okay, now we got God put them there.
To keep us from playing golf on Sunday.
Would that also keep us from being outside at Holy Ghost? Or that's a special case? Divine dispensation. What else?
Chance.
Chance, right. Just happen to be there.
Evolution.
Simply a product of evolution. They have a little niche that they're not only food for the birds, but we are food for the mosquitoes, so we're part of the great community. Anything else? Any other reasons that you can think of that one could give for why are there mosquitoes?
Keep us awake at outdoor services.
Keep us awake. There are a lot of practical advice. Practical uses for mosquitoes. Here, I think we maybe should have a contest like the tailings contest. Maybe we could combine them somehow and get mosquitoes to carry it off. Okay. What I've got so far is chance. If someone said, why are mosquitoes there? One answer is because. Yeah. Another would be evolution. Another would be similar. They are food for the birds. They have a place in the grand plan of nature. Then one is the devil put them there to test us, and the other was God put them there, but there was no reason assigned for that.
Carry
that pollutes the air. Created a spray that pollutes the air and the environment. You spray for mosquitoes.
Oh, did it?
Okay, how can we get that one down in some?
I'm trying to say it's a toxin.
Do they cause pollution, or you mean they?
Their presence has caused pollution.
Okay. So pollution is mosquitoes are a cause for pollution. But what is a cause for mosquitoes? Okay, now, on this one, we've got two kinds of answers again. The first, let's first analyze what kind of question this is. This is really the evil question. This is a sort of a trivial case of the big question of evil. Why is there any kind of pain or inconvenience or hurt in the world? And the kinds of answers you have given could apply to that, to the question of evil. So when we deal with mosquitoes, we are really responding to the question of evil. And one of the answers, of course, is there's no answer. That's one response. There's no answer. chaos, huh? That is, that's just sort of part of the garbage that's not somehow cleaned up. One of those unresolved problems. But then there was another answer, a little different sort, that starts the because answer. This answer is an answer that says essentially there's no sense in the universe in some respects. There's a lot of static there. Part of that static is evil. It's unexplainable. It's there. There's no real cause for it. But most of the other answers reflect our general human effort to find a cause. Why are there mosquitoes? And we respond, because. And then we give a reply. So, if there are because's, one is that they're part of a plan. Now, that plan can be natural selection, food for the birds. It can be evolution, you see. Why are the mosquitoes? Well, they're uncomfortable for us, but the birds love them. Keep the little swallows alive. Or you can say they are part of a plan in the sense that they have simply evolved and fit in a certain ecological niche. And that's one way of dealing with evil, is to say that evil is bad only when you see it as the sting on your arm. But if you see it in the total picture, the total plan, then it's not evil anymore. Then it's got a reason. There's always a reason for whatever happens that seems bad. That's one way people deal with the mystery of evil. Now, there were two others. One was to say that the devil put it there, and that's, of course, one way of explaining evil is to say that God has an adversary. And that adversary, as Jesus once said, an enemy has done this. The evil in the world is somehow not God's responsibility, but the responsibility of some counter power. But then there were others who said, well, God put them there. And the reasons given were to test us, our patience, I guess, to punish us, and to carry malaria. Okay, now notice again what's happened. We started with a simple question, and we discovered that behind it was a profound human problem, profound human question. And we now discover that there are a variety of answers. But I want to point out that we can divide these answers too. In one part, we can say that somehow there is a reason, and that this reason is related somehow to God. Now, part of a plan I put on the God side, because I think that many people would say that evolution is somehow God's way of doing things, and we'll see God behind evolution. But others would not. So others would put it up in this category, which is to say there's no reason of God behind evil. Evil is an alien power, either chance or chaos or the devil or a brute force of nature. So you end up again with two tough questions. The question here, of course, is if the devil's responsible, well then who's responsible for the devil? We get back to God again. We get back to the question of God's power. Is there a corner or a part of the world over which God does not have power or control? Starting with mosquitoes and working all the way up or back or down to the devil. The question of God's power, is there in fact still chaos or chance or some alien force or simply reality over which God does not exercise control? Well, if that's so, then God's power is limited. The other side down here say, oh yes, God's in control, all right. God even has control over the devil. The devil's not outside God's power, and the chaos and all the rest. Then the question comes up, well, God's got all that power, then why doesn't he love us enough to do away with evil? God could do it and doesn't. What kind of a God is he? So we started with the question of mosquitoes, we then got to the question of evil, but it ends up really being a question in theology called theodicy, a question of God and his relation to the world. If he is a God who has the power, why doesn't he use it? And if he doesn't have the power, why doesn't he then use it? And if he doesn't have the power, then is he really God? Or is he only a kind of competitor? And once again, you can spend many nights arguing that question. Is God somehow limited in his power or in his love? So, are you with me? Okay. Questions on this? Okay, what we're doing so far is showing that many of the discussions that we get into, like what happens to chalk? Power. Many of the questions we get into almost always boil down to religious issues of one sort or another. And those religious issues seem infinitely debatable. Okay, now let's just take the last one for a minute, the one on prayer. It seems like we're doing pretty well on the time. So we'll take a minute on that. What kind of answers do you get or do you hear when someone says, what happens when I pray?
Talk to God.
Okay, well, we can put it the other way too. God listens. Talk to God. What happens when I pray? God listens. Okay, what else?
God answers prayer.
God answers. Not only listens, but answers.
God changes.
God changes. Okay, God is influenced somehow. God changes.
God doesn't change, but the person praying does.
Okay? You don't talk to God, you change yourself.
Yeah.
Okay?
Nothing happens.
Right. Change yourself is one response. Another one is nothing happens. All in your mind. Or even not even that. What else? Something else back there?
You become very honest with yourself.
Okay? That's a result, isn't it? You become honest with yourself.
I may not obtain the results because God really knows what's best for me.
Okay. God knows, but knows an answer too. God knows, but doesn't comply.
Reveal the answer.
Okay. Reveal the answer.
God answers if you have enough faith.
Pardon?
God answers if you have enough faith.
Okay. God answers if you have enough faith. Caution.
You'll probably be surprised at God's answer.
Okay?
Yes, Bill, you care upon
you. All right, what happens when I pray? I cast all my care on God. Okay? Okay, let me review them again and see if there are any other possibilities. There are a group that say what happens when I pray is that I'm talking to God, that God listens, that he answers, that he changes, that he often surprises me with the answer, that he knows but sometimes doesn't reveal the answer. In other words, there are a number of them I, in doing this, cast all my care on God. A number of them relate then to the fact that there is God out there who responds. But there was one answer that said nothing happens, and another one that said you change yourself. Prayer is a kind of self-hypnosis, if I can use that, or auto-suggestion might be a better way to put it. Are there any other options?
We should never quit praying.
That's true. But any explanations for what happens when people say they're going to pray? we got a good start, and I can think of only one other option, and I think you'll see that as we put them up. I'm going to use the other side here. I'm going to cross the horizon. Let's see our options. First, we have what happens when you pray. One is to say that nothing happens, and then, of course, answer two would be that something happens. Okay. This question raises the human issue of how big is reality. To say that nothing happens is to say essentially that my world, or that the world or reality, is limited to the tangible, the seeable, visible, and there's nothing beyond this world. And by this world, we're talking now about what's visible or detectable. Talk about prayer, though. If we say something happens, we are testifying, we are saying theologically, that reality is bigger than what is seen or detected normally. It posits or suggests that reality is larger than it appears. So the first thing that prayer raises is the question of how big is reality. Now, if we say nothing happens, then, of course, we don't have to go further with that. But now something happened. There's a couple things that can go here. One is that you influence yourself. And if you see that, you see that is really just a special case of this view of reality. It's simply saying that your mind, you talk yourself into something or out of something. But there's another kind of answer to the question of prayer that we haven't mentioned yet, where something happens and yet God isn't involved. Can you think of any other way that people sometimes talk about prayer that would not involve just the person, the individual, but would not go so far as to say there's a God either? Well, quiet time would be sort of personal. It's hard to fish for answers. I always hear people get up and say, you know, come on, you're close. Getting warm.
How about if you're rich uncle died?
That was hilarious. Was that an answer to prayer?
How about if you're rich uncle
died? God wasn't involved in
it. It influences you.
Yes, you get something beneficial from it. Well, we kind of get back then to the question there of was it luck or accident or was it determined? Was there some power to do? The concept I'm thinking of that people often say is essentially an ESP approach. That prayer is mental telepathy. Okay, now that says that reality is bigger than what we now know. Parapsychology, that whole area. But it does not affirm God. It says reality is bigger, but it is still a reality which has some kind of, let's say, spiritual or mental dimension, but is not necessarily yet a reality that has a personal other out there. So this answer could be that there is indeed a greater reality, but it is essentially a mental reality. And then we get, of course, And then we get, as a third option, something happens, but someone responds. And I'm thinking of this now, of course, in terms of God, not just another person. That prayer, that reality is so big that there is, in fact, some other out there, a personal dimension. Beyond this world. Personal dimension. Okay, now some would say that's God and speak of God in very, very intimate personal ways, the way most Christians do. Others could say that one's prayers are affect God in some very, very minor or impersonal almost way. But let's just leave it here as a third alternative. Okay, now I put it over on this side, but now we're going to transfer it over here, because what we're dealing with here, as I've said, is the nature of reality, how big it is. Particularly, we're dealing with the question of, can God act in history? It's not only the question of reality, but the question of answering prayer. And one thing to say, God hears it and puts it on his, may give us a tape machine, and will, at the last judgment, play back all prayers ever made. But nobody prays simply because they want to get it in the record. You're praying because there is some concern you have and some concept or hope that God will respond. The question is, of course, here, how does God act? Some people would say, well, he acts through other minds. He acts mentally in history. God changes people's minds, and that's the way God answers prayer. I asked for money, and my rich uncle died, and I got money. Well, God made my rich uncle feel very ill, and there are others who say that God acts much more directly than that. That God acts not just mentally, but God acts physically in history. That is, that God moves atoms and molecules around. That he changes the course of storms, or divides a sea so that his people can cross it, and so on. In other words, the whole area of miracles. And if we can look at it just in the question of healing. See, some people say, how does God heal? Well, it's faith healing. Yeah, people's minds get so that they start working toward wholeness. Others say, no, God physically lengthens limbs and heals, removes tumors, and physically affects the world. That's an argument that has continued for a long time as to how God really acts, and whether there's a God, of course, first, then if there is, how he can intervene or work in history. Now, so far, you may say, wow, what a mixed up theologian we've got. He knows lots of questions and not much what I learned in catechism. Okay, but remember, we've been talking on this side. We've been talking about human beings and their ways of trying to conceptualize and talk about these very deep human questions. The question of freedom and determinism, the question of evil, the question of reality, and if it's big enough to include a personal God who can then act in history. Now, the only way that we ever get over this horizon is not by our ability to climb up higher, to build higher towers, or whatever, but rather to have an answer come from the other side. This kind of theology over here is sometimes called, and I'll write it at the bottom, theology from below, because it starts with human issues, questions, ideas, concepts, and tries then to build up some concept of God. Sometimes it's called natural theology. As Christians, however, we say that this is a blind alley, that these efforts of human beings to cross the horizon and see God as he is and understand reality in its totality are not possible. The answer must come from the other side. We must have a theology from above, or a better word, revealed theology. Revealed, not discovered. Natural theology, revealed theology. And what that does is, it says, if it's possible to find a starting point over here that will meet all of these issues, any theology, any revelation ought to be tested against how does it answer, how does it deal with these age-old human problems. For the Christian, we say that in Christ we find answers to these age-old human philosophical issues. We find them not by figuring them out, but by knowing Christ and hearing in His Word and the message about Christ, how God responds to these issues. Now let's just run that by and see what happens. Let's start with this question of God and history. The Christian doctrine of incarnation, it's almost bad spells mosquito. I came in here early and spent half an hour trying to figure out whether plural for mosquitoes had an E in it or not. I opted for the E and nobody objected, so I guess that was a good idea. The incarnation says that the Christian doctrine of incarnation says God can, first of all, there is a God who has entered human history, not just mentally now, but can in fact somehow take on human flesh. That God does not just sort of send mental messages, but that God's power is such that He can indeed come into human life and become one of us. So the Christian answer to the question of prayer really is to say, A, there is a God whom we know in Christ, and this God not only hears us, but comes to us and can, in fact, intervene in human life. So God can act in history, according to the Christian doctrine of incarnation, in a very profound and total way. But let's look at a second one. Let's take this one here. Are we determined or are we free? Again, if we look at Christ, first of all, now we've said that God can act in history. So therefore, the miracles of Jesus are in some way to say that we are not determined. The fascinating thing about Jesus' miracles for me is that they break through the traditional cause of chain and effect. That is, the ill are made well, the blind are made to see, the dead are raised. It is an effort to say there is no limit to the power of God to break through what seem to us to be options we cannot break. There are options that we have no choice. Instead, Jesus' message is one of forgiveness. We have here then both His miracles and His message, the message of the kingdom. The kingdom has freedom because free people, the free people are responsible people. And of course, it's you make your own luck. It's that concept. Well, of course, if you make your own luck, the opposite is, then you also make your own unluck. If things go wrong, people say, well, you have nobody to blame but yourself. The Christian doctrine of forgiveness, which is the heart of Christ's message, says freedom is okay. You can take it. You can take the responsibility to be free. God gives you that gift because He also gives you with it the elasticity of His grace, of His forgiveness. It's okay to fail. You can be free because if you fail, that doesn't rule you out of the kingdom of heaven or off God's lucky list. You continue to be a loved child of God as a forgiven child. Now, we talked about the incarnation. I'm just going to go over this quickly so you get a kind of general overview, then we have a chance for some response. What I want you to see is that the Christian message tries to respond to and deal with some of these very, very old human problems. And in fact, from a rather novel way. It doesn't say, as some modern teachers would say, sure, we're all free, and that means an awful responsibility placed on every individual. The world is absurd, there are no limits, everybody has to make his own way, and there is no one to fall back on, no no mistake, is tolerated. Now, evil, though, that's the bugaboo. God's power versus God's love. Well, here, if we look at the incarnation and the message of Jesus, now let's look at the crucifixion. And resurrection. Crucifixion says, greater love has no man than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. God's love is demonstrated to us in that he gave his son. God's love is infinite. The crucifixion demonstrates that God is willing to suffer to the end. But that does not limit his power. The way God deals with evil is not to stamp it out, but to endure it. That's the doctrine of the resurrection. The way God conquers evil is to let it do its worst and then for it to discover that it has no power. You know, like the really tough guy that can have the little fella come up and beat him, just hit on him. And the big fella can take it because he has the power, the strength to endure that. Now, the Christian doctrine then, a Christian doctrine of evil, there are many discussions about this, but the Christian doctrine of God related to it says in the crucifixion and resurrection that God, you know, he could have wiped them out, but he didn't. He reserved his power, but he was not defeated. The power was still there, and in the end, he simply, death did its worst, and it wasn't enough. And so, God's way of dealing with evil is not to erase it by some zap, but instead to let the evil do its worst and live on. And in fact, that's the way most of you deal with mosquitoes. Most of the time, you kill the ones you can, but if you get bit, you don't die. You endure it, and you live another day. The worst mosquito can do is still not enough. And so that is what Paul meant finally when he says, death, where is thy sting? Great, where is thy victory? Death does not have it. And that, for Paul, was kind of the ultimate, the last enemy, the most evil. Okay, now that's just a quick sort of overview. If I can summarize briefly what I've tried to do, and then maybe we have a couple of minutes to say something about it if you like. One, everybody's got an attitude about the basic problems of humankind. Questions of evil, questions of freedom and determinism, questions of is there a God or not. And the way these are answered is not by arguing them out or reasoning them out, but ultimately by accepting a revelation which makes sense because it responds in a surprising way to the questions. The answers we get are not necessarily the ones we would expect. Does God act in history? Well, more than you ever thought. He, in fact, becomes human. Freedom versus determinism. Not only are we free, but we are free to fail. Evil. Not only does God tolerate evil, but he wins over it. Cannot be conquered by it. And so, the Christian answer gives responses. And to be a Christian means to have this way of looking at some of these difficult questions. And to be able to respond in people to say that because I know God in Christ, there are answers to some of these imponderable questions, which I can offer to you. I may not be able to persuade you, but I at least give you the option of hearing them. Then perhaps you will see it in a new way. And hopefully then that will start them on a new road of thinking about God, which is, again, theology. Okay. Are there comments? Yes.
It seems to me that we've been talking completely about prayer being petitions to God, from the Christian to God. How about the prayer of thanks and praise and glory?
I would suppose that the reason we got into that box about talking about the way we did was because of the way I asked the question, what happens when I pray?
But it is important.
But of course the other is important. In fact, the Christian who knows a God who forgives, who endures and gives power, and who acts in human history can only respond with thanks, praise. That comes after we know this coming. Yes.
No, right now I say this. When I pray for instance, people in Cambodia, and at the same time that I pray, I commit myself to try to be a part of the answer. And that answer may never come in a lifetime. And that whole idea of God's time, so many prayers, we live in the hope of the resurrection, but we never experience resurrection in many of the prayer causes in terms of race in this country and other things. And so it seems to me that there can be that kind of teetering of just leaving it in God's hands, where do I take action, that kind of thing. So faith has to almost go beyond even waiting for resurrection or in this life.
We're very fortunate when we discover sometimes the way God responds to a prayer. And that's also true in evangelism, where we often speak with others about our faith and see no immediate response. But God can use that in His own time, in His own way. I think that your mentioning of God's pace, time, is very important, because we always want to set a limit. 10-day. Well, that's not God's time now. It's time for God.